This is the current federal tax developments for the week of February the 22nd, 2021. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, coming to you from Phoenix this afternoon, and we're going to be looking at some of the developments here in taxes and what else went on in this week. We actually get back to a couple of court cases. So kind of going back to our old style structure here for a while. Plus, we have a couple of IRS developments that are in play that aren't really our traditional thing, but we'll talk about a letter from Congress or certain Congress people, as well as an IRS admission of, oops, we may have fouled up a bit. We're going to start this week talking about a case that some of you may dismiss right away because it deals with the cannabis industry company. And you may think, well, I don't do 280 cap E stuff. Don't need to worry about it. But they really talk about two concepts that have application outside of any cannabis case. In fact, more often would have an application outside that. So I thought it'd be interesting to discuss the two things the court looked at there. We also have a taxpayer trying to get a little creative and claim that her legal malpractice settlement should have been treated as a physical injury settlement, meaning excludable from income, because what she sued her attorneys over was essentially, in her claim, fouling up a lawsuit against a hospital that was for physical injury. Turns out that didn't work out so well for the taxpayer, but she tried, so she got at least creative. We also have the IRS admitting that there is a bit of a problem with 260,000 notices the agency set out. I think a few of you may be aware of this problem when we discuss what it is, because I think you may have had clients that were impacted by it. I know I have one client that got one of these letters. So we'll see about how it goes. I know a number of people here, at least in Phoenix, have been reporting receipts of the letters by their clients. So we'll talk about what that is. And we'll talk about a letter that came from eight members of the House Ways and Means Committee. They were Democratic members, but interestingly enough, did not include the chair. That's asking the IRS, though, to push back the filing deadline from April 15th, arguing based on a couple of concepts, including the shorter tax season this year and just the continued issues arising from the pandemic, that it would make a lot of sense to push this back again and give us some more time again this year. So we'll talk a bit about that. Now, by the way, yes, I do know that is not necessarily a concept that everybody agrees upon. We have some strong feelings both ways among tax professionals. In fact, it seems to be, as far as I can tell, basically split down the middle. And nobody seems to feel like, on it. So, yeah, we'll talk a bit about it. Let's talk first about that court case, which is San Jose Wellness versus Commissioner. Okay. That is a published tax court case, 156 TC number 4, issued on February 17th. And the question that San Jose Wellness is trying to cover is the question of whether or not that bar at 280 cap E, does it bar a deduction for expenses other than those that are explicitly come under section 162A? Now, for those of you who do not know about the rules involving marijuana dispensaries who are dealing in what is a federally illegal substance, Internal Revenue Code Section 280 Cap E specifically disallows the deduction for amounts paid or incurred during the taxable year in carrying on a trade or business. As such trade or business, it consists of trafficking in controlled substances prohibited by federal or state law. Now, while I know a whole bunch of state laws, including Arizona's, allows for this, you know, this sale activity to take place and the dispensary is considered legal under state law, it's not true of the feds as of yet, and that creates this 280 cap E problem. And of course, the problem that dispensaries run into is that they can't deduct anything except cost of sales. But that's a whole discussion which we've had before and talks about the whole marijuana industry. But let's talk about a couple of other concepts here, because this dispensary, as is true of a lot when you have this sort of a tax problem, you try to get a little more creative and try to come up with new ideas about how to get around the problem. Well, the question of whether 162 was all that was barred was actually dealt with back in 2019, in the case of the Northern California Small Business Assistance Inc. versus Commissioners. And this is a pretty straight-up marijuana case. This one would not have anything outside of the cannabis industry. this is not going to have a lot of application, but it was a straight up saying that only 162 expenses should be barred by this 263 cap A, or not 263 cap, but 280 cap E, get the right one in there. And in the case of the Northern California Small Business Assistance case, they were going for a deduction for taxes under Section 164 and depreciation under 167. And the tax court in that case, back in 2019, effectively ruled that 280 cap E disallows all deductions. No deductions under any section shall be allowed, saying that that also meant those are both deductions, the deduction for taxes that are paid and the deduction for any amounts that are incurred for depreciation or picked up for depreciation, that those would be disallowed. Now, San Jose Wellness is really looking at, you know, the same basic issue. So you have to wonder, why in the world would this case come up? And more importantly, why would it be a published tax court case? I mean, published cases are supposed to deal with new concepts, and this whole is it limited to 162 items. Well, that seems to have already been a settled case, like 2 years ago. We had this settled. But the court said this one we're going to take a look at because they came in and essentially dealt with arguments that are more nuanced, and they're based on the text of the statute rather than a broad concept that only 162 items are impacted. So they started to look at the context here in the case of two specific expenses. And the two expenses we were worried about in this case, in the San Jose Wellness case, the first one was depreciation, just like it was in the earlier case 2 years ago. We're going to argue about whether depreciation is barred by this, but they have a different reason why it's not just that depreciation's not under 162. But it is that depreciation, they're going to argue, fails another part of the requirements. And then number two, they're going to also look at the IRS actually went and disallowed charitable contributions. Now, these are not charitable contributions that were deducted in arriving at AGI, right? These are not, or the ones that would be a deducted standard deduction for a trade or business expense. We've discussed that before. We talked about the tax credits available for, you know, when you have things like the tax credits that are available for making donations to certain charities. And if you're a pass-through business, you can claim that full deduction and still pass out the credit to your shareholders or to, you know, your shareholders, or your partners, as long as the payment to the charity is truly a 162 expense. So you're doing it for reasons that you expect a greater return than you're putting in. Well, this one was different. This is one where they're claiming it down below the line on Schedule A. And they're saying, well, that can't be related to the business. So let's talk about both of these and give you a little, you know, give you a little, you know, shall we say, we will give you a spoiler. Taxpayer loses on both. But let's talk about what they did, because it really is interesting the way they look at this, and it does have applications elsewhere. First, let's talk about depreciation. And the taxpayer said, well, you know, this particular rule, and the court even agreed, there are three tests to be disallowed. First, the deduction must be an amount paid or incurred during the taxable year. The amount was paid or incurred in carrying on any trade or business, and the trade or business is in trafficking. Now, we agree this business is trafficking, but we're going to argue about the first two items. We're going to take, in this case, the first one, the deduction is for an amount paid or incurred during the taxable year, and that's going to be the argument on depreciation. The argument for, basically, in this case, San Jose Wellness is that, let's face it, you go out and you buy a building and you're depreciating. Well, I bought that building, let's say, back in 2005, right? It is a 39-year commercial property asset. So I bought it years ago. I get to claim depreciation this year. But San Jose Wellness says, well, see, that wasn't really paid or incurred. Rather, it was paid or incurred back years ago when I bought the building. And the deduction is being allowed this year on the tax return. You know, so I'm doing it. But because it was not paid or incurred this year, I should be able to take it because this statute only impacts items that are paid or incurred in the current tax year. And the tax court said, okay, but here's your problem. They said, actually, they went back, and it was kind of interesting where they drew it out of. They drew it out of a 1974 U.S. Supreme Court case, the Commissioner versus Idaho Power. And what that case was fighting over was whether or not if you have a self-constructed asset, Idaho Power, I'm going to assume it was a power plant. You know, you have a self-constructed asset, and you have some depreciable assets that you're using in building it. You have some assets you are depreciating. You've owned them for a while. You're depreciating them. Do you have to capitalize that depreciation into the cost of the asset? Which means now we're going to basically tie up that, you know, five-year asset, or, well, this that's 1974, so it would have been a little different. But, you know, these days you take that five-year asset and have to turn around and start depreciating it over 30 years as commercial property. And what they looked back there was the court looked at this and said, you know, and that also had a decision of whether it was incurred. You know, the cost, although presently incurred, here's the catch. They said that the cost, while it was current and incurred currently for depreciation, that was the talk of the Supreme Court. They said because it has a future value, you had to put in the building. But what the court here is going to is getting into that line. The Supreme Court said that the cost, although certainly presently incurred, is related to the future and is appropriately allocated as part of the cost of acquiring an income-producing asset. They're saying, look, the Supreme Court agrees that depreciation is incurred in the year you're allowed to take the deduction under the tax law. That's your incurred year. We understand it's not the paid year, right? Obviously, we pay for it at various times. And if we pay for it on credit, then, you know, it may be paid after we claim depreciation. But we've incurred the expense. They're saying because of that, it's incurred. And since the rule said amounts paid or incurred, this was incurred, so you lose the deduction. Now, what makes this interesting is I know I've had discussions before with people, and we've talked about the issue of, you know, can you reimburse an employee for a home office? And, you know, the theory being, well, there's the accountable plan rules under Section 62. And Section 62 does talk about reimbursing an employee for amounts paid or incurred, right, on behalf of the business, that would be considered allowable, and you could reimburse that without having to up that into the employee's W-2. And a home office is useful because if you remember back to 280 cap, you know, good old 280 cap AC6, and if Ira Feldman's listening, yes, I remember the case. I remember your case that got us that wonderful section. In any event, you cannot lease your home office to the, to your business. Well, you can lease it there, you just can't claim any deductions. But you could reimburse, and that seemed like the easier way around it. So instead of having an income stream, you would have the reimbursement because obviously if I have a legitimate office and home, at least back before TCJA, that would be considered an employee business expense. It would have been deductible. I'd have gotten that depreciation. Some people, though, were concerned that, well, but you didn't really pay it this year. So can I reimburse you for an expense when really it wasn't paid this year? And the answer would appear to be from this theory that yes, because again, if you look to Code Section 62, A2A, you'll actually see it has the same paid and incurred language. And so the question is not that the employee paid this year. Obviously, they're renting their place. They could have paid it this year. But they're considered to have incurred the depreciation that would be allowed on the building. So I think this may help you make that justification. Now let's go to one that may not be so helpful, or it's something where the IRS gave up. And this may suggest if they want to stop giving up, and all they did to give up was change our instructions, as we discussed, maybe they could go back and say, yep, you know what? We were right all along. We're going to go ahead and keep it there. Now we had our second argument. The taxpayer argued that charitable deductions that were disallowed, these below-the-line charitable deductions, they said, look, they were not paid or incurred. Now it's not where they clearly were paid, they weren't done in carrying on any trader business. And they said, look, it's not related to the trader business because we wouldn't be allowed a deduction under 162. And their theory is, unless we be allowed a deduction under 162 for the amounts we're paying to the charity, and we're saying it does not meet the criteria in the regulations, well, we'd say today, does not meet the criteria in the regulations the IRS finalized last year. And so because of that, we should still be able to claim that deduction. The IRS should not be yanking deductions off Schedule A that may have been paid, let's say, by an S corporation that was in the marijuana dispensary business. Now, again, I don't know why you're paying your charitable contributions through there, but okay, you are. Unfortunately for the taxpayer, the tax court said the mere fact that carrying on a trader business, you know, in essence, 162 has somewhat different rules. They said really all the disallowances come under ordinary and necessary, that the expense could still be incurred in carrying on a trader business, just not ordinary or necessary. And because of that, they're saying these charitable contributions that are being paid by, let's say, the S Corp, that is a marijuana dispensary, well, they have some positive splashback on the S Corp, you know, on the business because, hey, you know, they're making these charitable contributions. They're saying that's enough of a connection to the business to allow it to be disallowed. Now, where that runs us into trouble is, some of you may remember this, right? A year ago, we've talked about earlier this year how the instructions to form 8995, 8995 Cap A, the instructions involving the K-1s from partnerships and S corporations in the qualified business income computation this year took away the line that suggested you should take charitable contributions and reduce your QBI by that amount. And of course, most of us said, well, obviously the ones that are 162 above the line, yeah, do that. But why would you ever get the Schedule A deduction? Well, in theory, if the IRS really wanted to, and they, because remember, all they've done so far is taken it out of the instructions, just quietly pulled a little clause, two words essentially, out of the instructions, and that's all they did. If they decided to go back in, it would appear this is a justification saying, yes, here it is, under the law, public tax court case, a charitable contribution can be related to a trader business, even if it's not otherwise a 162 deduction. Now, I think that's a lousy way to structure the tax law, shall I say, and I think it's reaching actually in both cases. I think it's reaching in this case as well. But the tax court went along with it, and so now we have law. I think we're back to the old rule that bad facts make bad law. I'm suspecting here the court was concerned that people would take these things that are, let's say, charitable contributions that would have been business-related, maybe do some advertising or stuff through various charitable organizations, and then claim, oh, I don't know if we'll get the real benefit, you know, total benefit, and then claim them as charitable contributions on Schedule A to get a deduction. So I suspect that may be why we got this answer, but the answer is worded generically that a charitable contribution could be related to a trader business. So keep your eye on this. Like I said, if the IRS wanted to go back, and remember, all they've done so far is played with the instructions to a form. And they really didn't say charitable contributions weren't related to trader business. They say you reduce it by expenses related to the trader business, what the regulation says. All they did was took charitable out of the list of examples and took it off the little table. So while that may imply you don't reduce it by charitables, they've never said you don't. And even what they've done so far is in a position that's not necessarily binding. So yeah, keep an eye on that. I'm hoping the service doesn't think this would be a great thing to do, but it's possible. Next up, we have a taxpayer that got creative with their thought process. It just didn't quite work out, but it really was an interesting creative process. This is a case of Blum versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2021-18. It was issued on the 18th of February. And this tax court case, it deals with a taxpayer who started out with the issue that the taxpayer was injured in a hospital. Apparently, she was told, she was admitted to a hospital, right, in Pasco, Washington, and she was, you know, going to be, you know, get a total left knee replacement surgery. She suffered injuries after being directed by the admission clerk to sit in a wheelchair, which it turned out was broken. Okay, well, she attempted. She fell on the floor. She sustained injuries, she said. And she sued the hospital. Now, when she went to sue the hospital, she basically went out and, you know, retained an attorney. And this was back in March of 2008. And her case went on for a couple of years. And we had a formal complaint filed in July of 2010. But while that lawsuit was pending, her attorney retired, right? This attorney retired from the practice of law. So she basically retained another attorney from the law firm. And they went and, you know, took on the case. In 2021, September of 2011, I should say, not 21, 2011, the trial court essentially granted summary judgment to the hospital and against Ms. Blum. She appealed the case without the attorneys, right? And the State Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court's decision. So she's now upset. She's upset. She believes the attorneys fouled up her case. So she turns around and she's going to be suing the attorneys. Now let's stop for a second. Let's think, what would have happened if Ms. Blum would have been successful and would have received an award? Well, if I in fact am, you know, I sit down in a chair that collapses, I'm injured, and I'm able to show the party was negligent, caused my injuries, I'm paid for that. That is under Section 104A2. Those damages are not considered to be income. That's an exclusion. Actual physical injuries are considered to be compensation for that is considered to be non-taxable income. So had Ms. Blum won her case, had she been awarded the damages, won her claim against the hospital, then it's probably the case that they would have been excludable. We can't say for sure because who knows how they would have worded the any sort of agreement they got into. But her basic claim sounds, you know, like it's completely all the way together on physical injuries and exclusion. Well, of course, as we know, she lost, but she's upset. Now she turns around and she sues the law firm. So in July of 2014, about 3 years later, less than 3 years later, actually, she sues the law firm. They negotiate. The law firm pays her a settlement of $125,000. She does not report this on her tax return, right? She says, okay, well, you know, I'm not reporting this on my tax return because essentially, you know, what it really was, let's face it, that $125,000 in her mind was money that she should have gotten from the hospital and should have been excludable. And she says, well, because of that, I should not pay tax on this, so it's excludable. IRS disagreed. And the IRS comes in and says, no, that's not for physical injuries. And the tax court basically agrees with the IRS. Why? Well, the first thing is they say and they point out that in the tax courts, all of their precedent, and in this case, the precedent of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, where an appeal would go in this case, you have to have, to get an exclusion for physical injuries, there has to be a direct connection between the payment made to you, you know, the nature of the damages being paid and the physical injury. And the court said in this case, the agreement makes it very clear that she was being paid for potential legal malpractice, you know, for whatever, you know, shortfall they had in their legal representation or their legal work. They were not paying her for the physical injuries, right? The law firm did not injure her physically. And because of that, she cannot get the exclusion. The court also didn't buy her theory because, and this may have been one where if she would have had testimony of this side or the settlement would have mentioned it, that maybe it would have worked, that the attorneys were intending to compensate her for the physical injuries. But the court said anyway, and then she said, okay, if it's not, then really, this is just a restoration of capital. Because due to their negligence, I didn't get a $125,000 tax-free settlement, and they're just making me whole on that. And the court said, no, we're not. But first thing is your claim loss, right? The replacement of capital is like the situation where, let's say, you know, your car is totaled, you know, by some negligent, you know, you're sitting there in the office. Actually, I had this happen to a client many years ago. You know, they're sitting there, and apparently some high school student lost control of his car, leaving the high school across the street, flew all the way across the street, I mean literally flew, you know, went into their parking lot and took out a bunch of cars, employees' cars, and, you know, and basically totaled them. Well, of course, those are damages. The money that those people got to replace their cars was considered to be a restoration of capital. Okay, that was the issue, you know, where it was. So there, she's saying, well, this is the same thing. It's a restoration of capital. Well, the court said first thing is you don't really have a loss that's equivalent to that totaled car, right? We don't have anything similar. They said, and your theoretical loss at best was this theory that you should have won in the courts. And the court said, we don't know you would have won. You know, regardless of whether you had great representation or lousy representation, you know, and I think fundamentally a judge is thinking, you know, the judges in cases tend to, if it's not an obvious technicality, you know, that you brought your claim late, whatever, you know, even if it's kind of odd, they don't seem to be arguing it right, if it seems like there's something there, they probably would have gone at least basically to trial, is the theory. So, you know, my guess is the court wasn't convinced her case was like rock solid, and the only reason she didn't get money was because the attorneys fouled something up. The court believed it may have been, you know, the attorneys had other reasons to get rid of her, including just getting rid of the hassle of being pulled out of trial courts in order to negotiate this thing. They said there's lots of reasons why you might have been paid. It wasn't necessarily to make you whole, and they said it's too speculative. So $125,000, it's all considered taxable income. So like I said, it was an interesting concept. It just didn't take off. Now let's get to the last couple of things we have for this week. So first up, the IRS put a notice on their website, IRS statement about CP59 notices. And that went up on the 18th. And this is something that some of you are aware. If you're not aware what a CP59 notice is, it's a notice that says, we don't, you know, we essentially don't have a record of you having filed your return for, in this case, 2019. And they send some of these out at about this time of the year in certain cases where they think there should have been a return. It hadn't been there. There are various reasons why they might do it. But in any event, the IRS sent out about 260,000 of these letters. And a lot of CPAs on the listservs I'm on began complaining that they had been receiving these, and they'd received a few of them. And what they had found with the clients they were working with was that in the vast majority of cases, these clients had filed electronically, and you had IRS acceptances, right? The return had been accepted, and you had the formal notification of acceptance from the IRS. And they're saying, and yet we're still getting these letters. And this has continued. Now, it's not all electronic. There are people who filed paper that also got these letters. So the question becomes, what's going on? Because clearly, you know, something's wrong. Well, and especially those electronic. The IRS announcement tells us, in this case, that there were about 160,000, issues out there, 160,000 of these particular items, I should say, or 260,000 of these out there, letters out there. And what they were dealing with was, you know, it's essentially going to be one of those issues that they had these letters out there, but they hadn't gotten through processing all the returns. That's their problem. So now we have an issue, right? We haven't gotten through processing the return. So the IRS suggests that, you know, we didn't do this. We have lots of returns left to process. These letters are, you know, well, yeah, a number of them are probably mistaken because people have filed. So if you filed a return, you don't need to contact us. Well, that's great, but not so great. Why not so great? Well, the problem is that there's got to be some of these every year, right, that are legit, right, that are at least that the IRS legitimately believes need to be sent out. They finished processing. Now, probably most of them truly are people that had not filed, but for some reason it looked like they had, or they'd attempted, or done something that, for whatever reason, flagged the IRS. And again, I don't totally understand the reasoning behind which ones get sent, because clearly I think we've all seen people that have failed to file for, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, the IRS hadn't contacted anybody. So it's not as if, you know, a few months after the end of the year, they write you to say, we didn't get a return normally. It seems a little odd, but okay, at least I haven't seen that background. Maybe my clients who fail to file and file late just never bother to tell me they got that letter. They're ignoring it anyway. But in any event, I haven't seen that one too often. But even in that case, there probably will be every year, I suspect, at least a couple where the IRS actually got the return and then somehow the system lost the return. So there probably, I would bet, at least one, if not more than a couple, of these 260,000 are people who have filed, but who, when the IRS finishes processing, they will show up as not having filed. And that's especially probably going to be true for people that filed paper returns, because again, those had to be processed and run by the IRS, and that's going to be an iffier process these days, so we'll have to see how that's going to work. So temporarily, I think the IRS is fixed, which is, well, just don't bug us, don't worry about it. I'm concerned that could be a problem, because the hitch is your client has been notified by the service that a return wasn't filed. Now, the computer is not going to know all this nuance. All the computer at the IRS is going to know is that there is a letter sent out. The letter was never responded to. Okay, and because of that, now you have an apparently non-responsive taxpayer who's failed to file, and I would think that could go badly for the taxpayer in a number of ways. And, you know, that's why I would say I would probably suggest at least responding and saying, look, here's what your website says. We believe we're in the class of people who have filed and, you know, shouldn't have this issue. If when you finally get all this done, you believe we are in the class of those that need to take some action, please, you know, write us again. And the reason to do so would be then at least if something comes up, you can show, yes, we responded. And will the IRS respond? Probably not. But at least now you've shown that the IRS is the party who is responsible for holding it up. And we're stuck still at this first letter. We're not on letter six, you know, letter 3, 4, 5 that the IRS may think we should be on at this point, or with an unresponsive taxpayer. So, yeah, there's still a pain however you look at it. Finally, we have a letter that was issued on the 18th of February from 8 Ways and Means Committee members. They're Democratic members only. And there are 8 of them, and they include some interesting members, right? We got 8 on the Ways and Means Committee that did it. And we do have the chairman of the Subcommittee on Oversight, Representative Pascrell, and we have the chairman of the Subcommittee on Worker and Family Support, Danny K. Davis. They signed it. However, we do not have as signing this letter Representative Neal, who is the chair of Ways and Means, which I find interesting for a letter like this. But in any event, this letter is asking, they're saying there are 8 Democratic members who are asking for a delay in the filing date. And what they point out is that they say, look, a few things are happening this year if you haven't noticed, IRS. For starters, right, they said health and safety concerns continue to keep taxpayer assistance sites closed, taxpayers homebound, right? I mean, and I think, you know, a lot of us have our offices running, you know, virtual. So some of our clients who may need it, let's say need assistance, or you might have had once. I don't have it anymore, but I used to have an elderly client that I would go out to every year at her assisted living facility. Obviously, in current situations, that one would never happen because they wouldn't allow me in that facility these days. You know, so there are clients with various issues that are having trouble, you know, working. And, you know, I seriously doubt, obviously, she passed away quite a few years ago now since I last did it. But I doubt she would have been super computer literate, you know, in terms of getting up to speed and doing it. And one of the reasons why to go out there was because she was extraordinarily hard of hearing. And, you know, we had to really kind of work on things to, you know, make sure that everything was fully understood. That's why phone calls didn't work very well, right? You really need to be in the room with her. to get this going. And I could see somebody like that having serious trouble, even with professional assistance, because, you know, like I said, I'm not going to be allowed in the room. And that's going to cause us some problems. So they're saying, you know, we should do that. We have these troubles getting it in. We have the condensed filing season because IRS, it didn't get started till February 12th. That means that some people are going to discover they owe money, you know, pretty close to April 15th because they couldn't get started. The returns couldn't be started until the February 12th date. And that gives them less time to plan. So they're suggesting the IRS should push back the date. They did not say July 15th. Although that's obviously going to be one of the things people are going to think about. Why don't we push it back to July, like last year? But they are asking about it. Now, remember, at this point right now, right? One nice thing they do say, though, which I would agree with here, if you're going to do it, announce it now, right? Don't wait until April 7th and then announce it, right? You know, in essence, if in fact it's going to be July, let's just say it's July now. You know, here in the next week or so, rather than waiting until late in the season to make the call. You know, having this early number would make a lot more sense if it's going to be done. As I know, the chair did not sign the letter. We also have not heard back from the IRS. So the question people are going to ask me is, are they going to do this? I don't know. They might do it, they might not. We can't really tell right now what's going to happen. But keep it in mind. My goal right now, though, we've had some discussion of this on the listserv in New Jersey. You know, there is an issue, too. I think one concern all offices have to have, especially if you're a smaller office where maybe, you know, you have 5-6 people in the office. You know, it is a concern this year. And just like last year, what happens if your office gets sick? And I think a lot of us have to be a little bit, at least tentatively planning out, you know, what would happen if, you know, worst case scenario, you know, hey, so far you've done fine. Nobody's come down with COVID. They come down with COVID April 4th, right? And they're down with COVID, right? So, and it's a couple of people in the office. And, you know, that could certainly complicate issues if you're one of those people that always love to go up to the April 15th and get returns out right through that date. Could be a major complication if that happened this year. And so I would suggest that, yeah, we'd like to plan a bit. Now, one of the theories is that going to July, would that relieve that problem? Maybe it's too early to know if we're still going to have the same potential issue in July, but at least it would give you more time, you know, to plan to do it. The flip side of it, though, is because I do know there are a lot of people that are very opposed to extending it. And that is, yes, I understand. If you tell clients right now that the due date's going to be July 15th instead of April 15th, information coming in the door dries up, right? People don't drop things off anymore. They don't bring things in. They decide they'll put off any sort of, if you're going to have a Zoom call with them, suddenly they're not available for the call. You know, they're not there. They say, we'll put this off later. You know, we'll get together, right? Okay, I think July is still optimistic on that whole we'll get together routine. It depends. You know, the vaccines need to be running a lot more. Well, they're running better now. They just need to keep running and ramp up in that time frame. And we'll see how things go there. But I still think July is probably, and secondly, since it would probably be June or mid-June, I think by the time we might be in a position where everybody that wants a vaccine will have it and will have their immunity up with the waiting times you have there. That would still be a very narrow time frame to have all those people come in, talk with you, and get them done. It's like it would be a very compressed time frame. So I think you still tell them, nope, we're just going to assume that, you know, if you want to come in and talk, we're probably going on extension, even in July, because we're not going to be able to come in and talk until very close to the date. And I need to be getting other things out. I need to be getting things out when we get to within that last month. You know, I can't really be booked solidly with interviews for every day during that period and not be able to get back and get things out. So we'll see what happens. But in any event, hey, we're talking about it. So this has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of February the 21st. Hopefully you guys are keeping nice and busy in your tax season. We have now gone past the February 15th date, so we're now heading toward our first due date, right? The pass-through dates on March 15th this year. I remember last year they didn't get extended, so, you know, we'll just keep assuming they won't. But those dates are coming up next, so that ought to be fun. We'll keep an eye on what's going on. We do have the bill supposedly working its way through Congress. We'll see if we actually get to a real bill. And once we do, what's in the bill? Currently, the proposal appears to have, you know, changes to certain tax credits for family and individuals, like the earned income credit, etc. You know, the $1,400 coming in. And that, by the way, may be the thing that would push the IRS over the edge and get us to have to push the tax season back to July, as if the IRS has to ramp up another check program. I think that would be difficult to have the service make April 15th while ramping that up and potentially changing the computer, right? There is some talk about making unemployment non-taxable, but that's not in the bill as far as I know so far. And so the question is, will it be inserted? Who knows? So we'll keep our eye, but it does not appear, at least to me, that we're going to have earth-shattering tax changes in this bill, which is good news during tax season, I always figure. So we'll do with that. But we'll keep our eye on it. And otherwise, we'll keep around what else is happening here in the area of federal taxes. And I look forward to seeing you back here next week for more current federal tax developments.